I'm Marvin Landsverk, and this is the last in a series of sessions that's been going on this week on William Blake, and the title of the series has been Not in That Image of God, William Blake's Contrary Visions of God. And the title for today is the title of one of Blake's prophetic poems called The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. And if you're new in the village today, or you haven't heard any of the ones going on before, and in your word you might not understand what I'm talking about, don't worry, because I don't know what I'm talking about either, so I don't think it'll be a problem. And besides, I think part of Blake's purpose in writing is to write stuff that is obscure enough that his purpose is to invite energetic participation in asking what the heck he's talking about. And the purpose of much of his stuff is to confuse you and to shake you up. So if you feel confused at all, I think Blake would think he's been successful. To do a little quick situating, William Blake is a late 18th century English poet, painter, visionary. And he recognized very early on the problems that were being created for spirituality by the rise of modern society. So with the rise of industrialization just beginning, materialism and science and scientific mindset starting to control the way people think, Blake saw grave problems for spirituality, and he was a very spiritual person. And his reaction was to reject much of what he saw happening that was creating the world that we live in today. And most of his works are prophetic calls to recognize those problems. And I think that's one reason why Blake remains as popular as he does in lots of different settings. Because he has a message for people that live in this world today. One thing that he particularly rejected was the image of God that was coming into being since the Renaissance, but especially with in the 18th century. And I've got a few slides today that I'll show you.
Let me flip that on. If someone knows how to work the light in here.
The image of God since really the Renaissance had been, the stamp had been put on the visual image of God by Michelangelo, and this is his God from the Sistine Chapel. That's powerful God, old man, which to Blake was the incorrect, completely wrong, in fact, the terrible view of God given what happens to that view of God in the 18th century. And that's Blake's versions of 18th century version of that God. And that's the God that Blake rejects. That God in the 18th century becomes, in Blake's mind, associated with science, with deism. That God is Isaac Newton. And that's Isaac Newton as God creating the world and mapping out the planets and where everything lies. And Blake couldn't stand looking at the world as a scientist and saying this is the way things are, because that wasn't the way things are in his visionary view of things. It's the way to see things as they are is to imagine, not to do science. So Blake saw a problem, and there's a face to that problem, and that's organized religion of his days, God. And there's another one of his sort of horrific images of God creating Adam. And that God is not a God that deserves worship to Blake. In Blake's, a quick rundown of Blake's cosmology, what happens at the fall, when Adam and Eve fall for Blake, they bite the apple, the world turns upside down at that point. Think of it as a flat plane. Everything flips upside down. And at that moment, what we think is up now is down. Does that make sense? If we're walking around upside down, we think that's up, but we're upside down, so that's really down. And in his view, organized religion worships this God that's up there. But if we're upside down because of the fall, what we're worshiping is that God, not true God. And that God is equivalent in many ways with Satan, because that's the God of materialism. That's the God of Isaac Newton. So what Blake's intent was throughout his life was to turn the world right side up again through his poetic method, to get people to realize that that's not God, but God looks like something else and has different significances. And Blake's partly responding to the organized church of his day and some of the evils created in the name of religion. And you can, without getting into the details, the historical details, some of the evils always created in the name of religion, Blake says that can't be part of God's purposes. So, true God to Blake was something more like that. And you could view that as a mirror, and to Blake, true God is considered to be yourself. And that's not going to work as a mirror for everybody in here, and if you're a man, it will. If you're naked, it'll help even more. But, which, again, and Blake sometimes was. He'd be found in his backyard by his friends in London. They'd knock on his door, he wasn't there, and they'd go through his backyard. And he and his wife would be in his backyard, naked, reading from Milton's Paradise Lost, acting out the scenes of Adam and Eve together. And that's, and Blake lived this stuff. But that, in Blake's mind, to say that's God, that's you, or any of his feminine versions of it too. If you're going to look for God, don't look up there, which is down. Where you need to look is in here somewhere. And I think that's important to see. Another way to say that, God to Blake is the mystery of incarnation. The mystery of God and people wrapped up together is the only way that made sense to him of thinking about God. So Jesus is his primary deity. When Blake thinks of Creator God, he thinks of Jesus, the mystery of incarnation. And he thinks of people. So Blake's image of God that he's trying to project is something like this. And I've got two kind of introductory comments to sort of start thinking about Blake's marriage of heaven and hell that help make some sense of it. And one of them is this particular plate. It's an illustration from that his illustrated poem, The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. And in, well, it's one more comment about that the incarnation. What Blake does is he takes traditional Christian doctrine that people have a soul or that there's some connection between God and us. He takes that to an extreme and explores the extremes of that. And he comes up with his line out of The Marriage of Heaven and Hell that all deities reside in the human breast. All deities reside in the human breast, not elsewhere. And that seems like a radical statement. And yet again, in Blake's time, he felt that the radical problems with modernism called for radical reactions like this. The institutionalization of the wrong God, Blake felt, called for extreme measures to emphasize that God doesn't exist there, but exists sort of in the human breast. This particular cartoon illustration, I think, is useful to think about Blake for a couple reasons. One, because it can show how Blake takes some other Protestant doctrines to heart. And I feel like I have to please read something out of the Bible in a session, so let me read something out of Ephesians for you. And this is a quote that Paul Erlander loved to read up here. And this is in Ephesians 1. Pauline letter, where near the end of Ephesians 1, the writer says, "For he has made known to us in all wisdom and insight the mystery of God's will, according to his purpose, which he set forth in Christ as a plan for the fullness of time." Here's the plan: to unite all things in him, things in heaven and things and things on earth. So there's God's plan, says the writer of a letter to the Ephesians. God has a plan, and it's simple. And Dan Erlander used to like to say, and this is sort of a response to the Gnostics that would say, you've got to study and learn all this stuff. It's a confusing mystery and spend a lot of time before you can ever figure out what the gospel means. Paul says, it's simple. The mystery of Christianity is God's plan is to bring about unity of all things in him, heaven and earth. And Blake takes that and comes up with the marriage of heaven and hell. And really, his marriage of heaven and hell is that message explored in perhaps radical extremes, and yet I think that message itself is fairly radical. So that's what we're up to today, is to explore what that radical message might mean in the mind of an 18th century poet. Back to this cartoon then. What we've got here is Blake's instructions on how to read Blake. And when you read Blake, often what you see is mystery and confusion, and people say, wow, this is going to take me 3 graduate courses or more before I can even make sense of this. And I think sometimes people associate Blake with Gnosticism, and in fact he's influenced by it. Like, you have to be a Blakean to read Blake. But I think Blake is a Pauline in the sense that he doesn't think you have to read every work that he ever wrote and know all his mysterious ways of reading the Bible, because the message to Blake, as it is to in the letters of the Ephesians, is simple. It doesn't take any study. You know it. Here it is. God wants to bring about unity. In Blake's Marriage of Heaven and Hell, he expresses that unity as the unity of heaven and hell rather than heaven and earth, but he means something quite similar. And here's Blake's instructions on how to read Blake. And what I want you to draw your attention to is the little figures down below there. I don't know, can you see those very well? I'll describe them and maybe you can see what they are. In Blake's illustrations, he usually has a major illustration on a plate and lots of little flowery stuff floating all around. And here, just on a plate with words on it, he's got this little cartoon. And this first figure here is this winged, feminine figure playing with a little infant. And that's stage one of education for Blake. Here's what happens, what should happen in the education of a child and in reading Blake. So the first thing you do with a child is you don't give a child Blake to read, and you don't give them anything to read, you play with them. And there's all kinds of discussion in the late 18th century about how to educate children going on, and some very rigid rules for education being set up. And Blake's first step is simply play. In the middle there, after passage of time, you've got the middle figure. And you can see on the left then is adolescent. On the right, adult figure. And what you can't see is that there's a book that they're both looking at between them. And the adolescent is pointing to the book. And there's stage two in education and reading with some sort of tutor involved, and it's the adolescent that's asking the questions, or it's putting the energy in. That's not a lecture format, so it's unlike what I'm doing right now. So actually what I'm doing now is quite un-Blakean, and I won't just dish Blake out to you, otherwise I would, I think, have bad dreams tonight or something. So you've got active child asking the questions about texts. Then you can see part three over there in the far right is that same, now perhaps older, child reading a book by him or herself without anybody there to impose their view or reading of that text on, but interacting with text by yourself. Final stage then is that. And you can see in that picture, underneath the figure's knee, there is a skull. And what you might not be able to see is under here is that same book, the leaves of a text. And what Blake is saying is, play, read books with somebody else, read them by yourself. The object of reading and studying anything is to reverse the fall, to turn the world right side up again and see where God is. And it's happened to that figure, which is given the title of the renovated man in Blake's illuminations. And what happens when you're renovated, is the apocalypse happens in the blink of an eye. It's not something that's going to happen in the future sometime in God's own time. God's own time, because God resides in the human breast, is now, depending on the way you look at things. And there's the book, whether that's Blake's Marriage of Heaven and Hell, the Bible, or whatever you happen to be reading, you don't need it anymore, because you've got sort of the vision, the direct experience of God. And I think, thinking of that particularly as Blake, you can read Blake, and Blake can tell you some stuff, but part of what Blake's saying is, you read me, but get rid of me. You don't need to be a Blakeian to get to that point. And in fact, no text can get you there. It can only get you so far, and you can't see the ultimate truth without sort of experiencing it yourself. So I think that's one answer to why Blake isn't really a Gnostic. It's quite simple for him. And what that figure is experiencing is what Paul's saying in Ephesians, the unity of heaven and earth. Blake's terms, the unity of heaven and hell, which I'll say more about. One other, I think, thing that's important to understand for understanding Blake is his doctrine of contraries. And I don't know if you're going to be able to read it. You've got it in front of you. I'll refer back to it again after we turn the lights. But on that, the right page here, Blake lays out his doctrine of contraries, which is at the heart of the marriage of heaven and hell. Now let me just read that to you out loud, and this is sort of a framework then for reading the marriage of heaven and hell. It starts halfway down the page, and he says, it's right there, "Without contraries is no progression. Attraction and repulsion, reason and energy, love and hate are necessary to human existence." And he goes on to explain, from these contraries spring what the religious call good and evil. Good is the passive that obeys reason. Evil is the active springing from energy. Good is heaven, evil is hell." Okay, got that? So he's saying, human existence exists by contraries. You've got to have them. And what true contraries are reason and energy, heaven and hell. And then he says, religious people call those good and evil, but that's not quite right. And he goes on the next page over here to continue this doctrine. And he says, "All Bibles or sacred codes have been the causes of the following errors. That man has two real existing principles, a body and a soul." So he's saying these are three errors. That man has a body and a soul. That energy, called evil, is alone from the body, and that reason, is called good, is alone from the soul. Three, that God will torment man in eternity for following his energies. Okay, so those are three errors. Terrible. To say man has a body and a soul, he's saying, is bad. To associate evil with energy and the body and reason with good and the soul, also incorrect. And that God will punish you for following your energies is the opposite of morality for Blake. Blake's response is, and the rest of this is, "But the following contraries to these are true." This is too fuzzy to read, I'm sure. "Man has no body distinct from his soul. For that called body is a portion of the soul discerned by the five senses." The other outlet of the soul in this age. So he's saying, you don't have a body and a soul. What you've got is a body and a soul together. And that sounds like maybe it might mean the same thing, but to Blake, what he's doing is rejecting dualism. And he's saying body and soul are inseparable. And that's the mystery of incarnation, Blake. You can't separate them. You can't make man evil then, people evil, and God good. The two are fused together. Number two, energy is the only life and is from the body, and reason is the bound or outward circumference of energy. Okay, so energy is what's the life force, comes from the body, and then your reason isn't separated from all this, but he's got a very visual model for this. It's the outward, the circumference of energy. is reason. Principle three, energy is eternal delight.
Eternal what?
Delight. So, in Blake's mind, there's both truth and what Blake will find is that's the true message of the Gospels. And he's organized religions that don't see that, he says, are making a mistake. And in his day, that emphasize reason too much, that come up with laws to say you've got to control your energies and don't do this, don't do that. That kills the human spirit in it, and it kills God at the same time. So one other aside, Blake, the reason he doesn't like the terms good and evil in this sort of system he sets up, he likes contraries, but he doesn't like negations. And a negation to him, you can think about this in mathematical terms, an A and a negative A come together, cancel each other out. And that's what happens when you have good and evil, they come together, nothing's left. So what he, the way he views it is what you need are contraries, reason and the imagination, where they come together and they can interact in creative ways. They don't cancel each other out.
Now, why are good and evil, why do they cancel each other out, and for example, attraction and repulsion don't cancel each other out?
That's a good question. I think, when I think about that, I can't quite see it the same way Blake does either. In his mind, there's a very clear difference between contraries and negations. And the only way I can think about that is mathematically. You've got a 1 and a negative 1, put them together, they're gone. And yet, attraction and repulsion, you think about this in physical terms too, you've got a dynamic system going. Attraction and repulsion still is a dynamic system, so when they come together, they don't disappear.
I think, as you pointed out, he's reacting to the church of his time, and it seems to me that good and evil have special significance in that context.
Yeah.
Whereas the other dualities that one might bring up don't have that same significance.
Yeah.
And so he sees the attribute of evil as being a negation of various things that he talks about.
Yeah.
Energy of the body, etc.
And evil is sort of even defined by the church as sort of as the opposite of what is human desire, creates sort of a definition of evil for the church. So whatever humans desire, you can't do that, again, in Blake's mind. So Blake, what he does is he writes The Marriage of Heaven and Hell as his first sort of philosophical prophetic work to expound these views. And it's sometimes called, in a number of circles, as the most perfect book ever written in the English language. And I think that's one reason why it's worth spending some time talking about tonight. And I never believe hyperbolic statements like that about anything. And yet, I think what lies behind that statement is something that's pointing to the fact that the book is interesting. And one reason why it's said to be the most perfect is simply because Blake is both artist and poet. And the way he produces his work is to fuse the art and the poetry in a way that combines them in a more complete whole than any other text that has ever been produced. And that certainly is true. It's not hyperbola. You can see his method is to etch copper plates, to have an illustration, and then he's sort of painting the words together so that the words even are part of the design in the picture. And the pictures often have sort of linguistic significances as well, which is, it's really fascinating to start getting into some of the details of all that. We won't have time to talk about a lot of those details right now. But one of Blake's hopes really is in producing The Marriage of Heaven and Hell is to illustrate Paul's radical, simple statement that God's plan is to unify these things, not to keep them separate, which Blake says organized religion too often tries to keep things separate and to not show the radical unity of things. And again, in Blake's mind, in Ephesians it says, according to God's purpose, which in the fullness of time is to unite all things in God. Blake doesn't view that as happening in the fullness of time in the future. What he wants is it to happen now. And it can happen now, depending on your point of view. So if anybody in here blinks their eyes and ascends through the ceiling, or I guess descends or something, then we'll know something has happened. So what I'd like to do is flip through just so you can get a sense for the other illustrations in the Marriage of Heaven and Hell, and we'll turn the lights back on and look at some of the texts that I'd like to look at specifically today. This thing was written in 1793, just to give you a date. And let me just flash through some of the other illustrations. You can see here, you've got this devil. The speaker of this whole poem is this devil, which to Blake doesn't mean evil. It means energetic figure. And there he's giving instructions to this slow, stupid person that's writing down his wisdom, and the other person's trying to cheat and copy off the other page. And over there you've got this island with deities rising out of the ground and in the middle of water. So some of these pictures have direct connections to the text on the plate. We'll go back and look at the text in a minute. There, this floating figure over sort of a dead Adam figure that's trying to be renovated. And over there on the bottom right, you can see that that's a classic archetypal symbol of incarnation, of bird holding snake. Birds that fly around in the air is sort of the symbol of the spiritual. The snake, which is creeping around, can't remove any part of its body from the earth, is the symbol of the earth. Fuse the two together, that's the marriage of heaven and earth, heaven and hell, two together, that's sort of the mythic mystery that Blake's exploring. There's a Leviathan, a snake that appears in one of the visions, and there's the renovated man plate that I showed you the detail of. And this is a close-up then of another bottom plate illustration of Nebuchadnezzar, as it's called in one place. It's just material man. This is what Isaac Newton is. Someone who studies the earth, is the earth, looks at bugs, never will see God. And there's close-up. Okay, if I could get the lights back on and... And as I said, I don't want to just proclaim about Blake to you because it would be sort of an anti-Blake method. So what I'd like you to do is, does everybody have a copy of this Marriage of Heaven and Hell in front of you? If you could, flip open to page 35 for me. And with apologies to anybody who was here Thursday, what I'd like you to do is... Yeah, how many? Okay, one of the most famous parts of the Marriage of Heaven and Hell is this list of 70 proverbs, where Blake lists 70 different proverbs. He labels them proverbs of hell. Again, they're not evil. These are proverbs of energy in his mind. What I'd like you to do is just pair up with somebody and quickly read through some of these proverbs and pick one that you like and one that you're not so sure of, that you're not sure whether if you agree with it or not. And I think these proverbs are one quick way to get at what Blake is saying, because he puts these phrases in nice, pithy ways. So go ahead and discuss it with a partner. Read through some of these. Pick one that you like the message of, that you think you agree with. And then pick one that you're not sure you agree with. Does anybody else need copies of this stuff up there? Okay, how's everybody doing? You ready for me to catch up? I got to save myself time to hold forth a little bit at the end. If we take Blake's advice too far, English professors wouldn't have anything to do, so.
Right. Don't want you to be out of the job.
Yeah, right. So. And you could all go out the door now and leave quick, leave me here by myself. So let me hear some of the ones that you like. Just shout them out and let's look at them.
Damn braces, bless, relaxes.
Damn braces, bless, relaxes. What do you like about that? Is that
yeah.
Useful advice even?
You're always dancing, yeah. And you're not going to accomplish very much. Yeah. But if you relax,
Good psychological advice, even. How about some others that people like?
Can you see 10?
Number 10?
Yeah, that's the one I like.
Yeah.
What, Eternity?
Yeah, Eternity and The Busy Bee and The Hours of Thought.
Yeah, so that whole series. Eternity is in love with the productions of time. This is number 10 and 11 and 12. The Busy Bee has no time for sorrow. The Hours of Folly are measured by the clock, but of wisdom, no clock can measure. What does that mean to you when you read that one?
Which one?
Well, that series.
I'm a beekeeper, and when I see my bees, you know, they're not sorrowing or anything. Their whole goal in life is to you know, build all of these bees, and your person that isn't busy, he has a lot of time for sorrow. And then the Hours of Folly, you know, you measure them by the clock, but you know, if I can kind of get this spiritual feeling of wisdom, you know, no clock can measure. So I really like that. This one.
And it says,
anyway,
says something to a beekeeper.
Yeah, all that too.
Okay, and you had one too that you like?
Number 7.
7 was dip him in the river who loves water. And what does that mean to you? What is that?
People like water, they'll go swim.
Okay. So if someone likes something, let them do what they like.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure and sweet.
I like number 15. No bird soars too high if he soars on the wings.
Okay, yeah. You know,
I think that's really neat because I think myself, I have passed through different stages where I wanted to be like someone else.
Yeah.
It hasn't worked. I don't get very high.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
And that really that is saying be yourself, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I've got that a big poster. It's got that as the motto at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
It's, no bird flies too high if he flies his own wings, and it's this big picture of Michael Jordan. I don't know if that's crass exploitation of Blake or not, but I still like it. And any others that people particularly like? Yeah.
Yes, I like that. Let's see what number it is. Looks like it's 46. You never know what is enough unless you know what is more than enough.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, so if you follow rules that tell you to stop, you'll never know if that was enough.
Well, it's also the thread of action, the whole thread of action that runs through these.
Yeah.
One must act in one's life, and that's how one would find out what is enough, by experiencing more than enough.
Right. So my daughter knows what's enough ice cream because she eats until she gets sick, and that's then she knows. And any others people like?
67.
Six, okay, 67. Is that Sooner Murder, that one?
Yeah.
Okay. So you like Sooner Murder, an infant in its cradle, the nurse unacted desires. What do you think about that one?
I like it, but it's one of the more interesting ones.
Yeah, that's one of the more famous ones. So I'd say I used to like that a lot till I had an infant. Now,
right.
I'm not so sure. All right, what does that mean?
Well, it goes along with the others. I mean, action.
Yeah.
And kind of, if you soar with your own wings, then it's okay, and do whatever you want.
Yeah.
Desire,
Did anybody pick that one as one that you don't agree with? Is that Christian advice?
The consequences of it can be questionable.
Yeah.
And similarly with, if we're always trying to find out what is too much by doing too much.
Right.
I mean, how do we know, what are the consequences of that? Interesting.
So any others here people sort of question whether this is good advice or not?
Is that, to me, it kind of relates to abortion almost. It says sooner to murder an infant in its cradle. I don't know, that's just what I want to get out of it.
Yeah.
I surely think it's a matter of semantics. I don't think it's the words are what really...
Yeah.
You don't take them for face value.
Is there any here that you made you uneasy when you read them that you didn't think would be very good advice, or do you like most of these?
Not uneasy, but what's the best wine is the oldest, the best water the newest.
Yeah.
What do you pull out of that?
He's playing off of some of Jesus' statements there, I think. You don't put new wine.
Old wine.
Yeah. And so the best wine, he says, best wine is oldest, best water is newest. And some of that's sort of logic, isn't it? But what's, there must be a symbolic. Yeah. Any ideas there? Best wine is oldest, best water is newest. What's, he's not giving you just culinary advice. I don't think Blake's only interested in that.
I kind of took it to mean that the man-made things are, need time to gain importance, whereas natural things, God's things, are important right away.
Hmm.
There's a line near there also that says something. What are we on? What number?
What number is that?
58
58? Yeah. Best wine is oldest, best water is the newest.
Number 56, to create little flowers in the labor of ages,
yeah.
Kind of relates to the same way that I was thinking.
So, thinking what? Explain that again.
Thinking that to do, that nature can do something so simple, a little flower, and yet it is a miracle, and no man or woman can do this, and it takes time for our art to be accepted oftentimes, and yet nature is now.
Yeah, that's, and I don't have I have an easy answer. It's too cheap, though. I mean, that's a proverb that's expressing a contrary again. Old and new, nature and man, or nature and people, as you're saying, Blake's playing around contraries, and that doesn't explain the meaning of it, but it says something. Blake's fooling around with beginnings and end, and that's what he's saying when eternity is in love with the productions of time. Eternity, which we think of as at the end, production of time is the beginning is the end, and for Blake, the natural world and humans should be together in all the sort of unity that he's seeing, the unity of everything. I think that's part of what's going on there. I don't think that explains everything, but any others that you wondered about?
Yeah, it just seemed what was real good. It says, excess of sorrow laugh, mm-hmm. excess of joy weep.
Mm-hmm.
I've read about like people in World War II, they just didn't have, you know, they had to laugh to, you know, to bear it.
Yeah.
You know, and then the excess of joy, you know, finally, you know, gets you to where you're kind of sick of it.
Yeah. There's this notion of if you follow anything to an extreme, it's going to turn into its contrary.
I don't like number 30. On page 36.
Let man wear the fell of the lion, woman the fleece of the sheep.
Uh-huh.
Why?
Because it gives an image of man devouring woman.
Devouring?
Or
strong.
Yeah, so let men wear lion skins, let women wear sheepy stuff.
Right.
So that sounds sexist, maybe.
Well, and it's just that the lion is the pursuer of the
sheep. Yeah.
Well, it's easier for women to get dressed, though.
It's easier to put on your sheepskin coat. At least it's easier to get it to begin with. Let me put some of what Blake's doing in the Proverbs and in another conceptual frame, and then look at some of the other stories in this thing. And Proverbs are one thing. Blake also writes lots of stories, and let's look at some of the stories with the time we've got left, which isn't a whole lot. But here's my conceptual framework, which sort of governs the way I approach most of what Blake does. And again, it's based on a contrary. Blake's always working with contraries and exploring that in all kinds of different ways. One of the things he's doing in his Proverbs is writing contrary proverbs to the Proverbs in the Book of Proverbs. And the type of Proverbs in the Book of Proverbs, just to throw some English professor type language at you, and then to get to the stories, are affirmative. Can you read that? That's too light.
Pretty light.
Yeah, it's my only one. Anyway, affirmative utterances. And so an affirmative utterance is sort of a linguistic characterization of the type of speech act that Proverbs are, really, sort of the literary genre of a proverb, but particularly biblical use of those. That is, the meaning of a biblical proverb doesn't come from the individual will of the speaker saying, I've got an idea. Spare the rod, spoil the child. What it is, it's this long tradition of wisdom, and what you're doing is you're uttering a proverb out of this huge long tradition that takes its meaning because it inhabits this tradition, creating order and repeating the law of the fathers for the Hebrews. By repeating the laws of the fathers, you'll maintain order in the present by continuing to enforce those laws and calling that wisdom. Linguists label it sort of affirmative utterances. You affirm this wisdom of the tradition. Blake's use of proverbs, he invents a new type of proverb. He really does. He doesn't do it single-handedly. There are sort of some literary precursors to this, which we don't care about now. But it really is, it's quite different from what anybody else does. And what I think it's useful to think of them as is performative utterances. Now, performative utterance is a statement that performs the act that it refers to in the act of speaking. The propositional content isn't important. Like, if I say, that board is white. That's a statement that we could say it's true or it's false. In this case, more or less true. A performative utterance, whether it's true or false isn't what matters. What matters is whether it does enact what it refers to, whether it's successful or not. So, and whether it's successful will depend on whether the person uttering it has power to make it come true. And think in religion and law, particularly where you find performative utterances. A judge declares someone guilty, and they'll say at the end of a trial, you are guilty. And by pronouncing that, they are bringing something into being. Or a priest at a wedding ceremony, usually most traditions will have the language used, I pronounce you husband and wife. And it's the uttering of the speech that makes it legally true. I pronounce you husband and wife, the speech act, if the person pronouncing those words has the authority to do that because they're vested by powers of the law of Washington State and by God or whatever, then is the case. Or a king making laws, I decree that if the king's got power, that law exists. That's a performative utterance. Does that make sense? Blake's proverbs are performative utterances. They're not affirmative utterances. That is, they create wisdom in the act of speaking it. They don't refer back to this long tradition of wisdom that they yank out pieces from the past. That whole notion of yanking things from the past and making them work like laws is what that God does. It's not what this God does. What this God does is to create wisdom that works for the moment with these performative utterances. And a couple quick comments about that and then some illustrations. So many of the proverbs that we were just looking at are phrased in the form of commands, like I command that or I decree that. You can go through those and see that's how some of them work. Or many of them are definition proverbs. And a definition is a type of a performative. If you're using Webster's dictionary's definitions, those function as affirmatives, saying here's what this word means in this tradition. Blake's definitions have no tradition behind them. He's giving things new definitions. So I decree that this word now means something else is what he's up to. Now, a couple things about performatives in Blake's mind. A performative, if an individual speaks it, once you speak it, if someone else follows it, all of a sudden that's become the same old thing, an affirmative utterance. So if you've got a king decreeing laws for himself, fine. If anybody's starting to follow those laws, stick them in a book, then you've got the book of Proverbs and the same old problem. So that's the problem Blake faces. Here's all this wisdom he wants to utter, but you can't run around being a Blakean disciple and start following this stuff, or Blake becomes that God, and then you've not gotten anywhere. So that's always the problem Blake's going to face. How do you get someone to move from sort of that last small panel of reading something to vision. And Blake uses a number of methods to illustrate that, but the performative is the key. One is to keep uttering performatives and leave them behind, move on to the next one, don't give anybody time to systematize it. And in your text, Blake's got a couple stories about that very thing. I think some of, they're short enough that we can take a look at these. On page 38, it's plate 11. Looks like it might be Roman numeral 2, but it's plate 11. It's right in the middle of page 38. Are you with me? Right after enough or too much. So this is what happens. The list of 70 proverbs has just been laid out there. And then Blake tells this little story. It says, the ancient poets animated all sensible objects with gods, or geniuses, calling them by their names and adorning them with the properties of woods, rivers, mountains, lakes, cities, nations, and whatever their enlarged and numerous senses could perceive. So this is in the good old mythic days. And particularly, they studied the genius of each city and country, placing it under its mental deity. So think Greek mythology even here, and that's Greek mythology, got a river, that river's got its god or nymph that lives in it. Till a system was formed, which some took advantage of and enslaved the vulgar by attempting to realize or abstract the mental deities from their objects. Thus began priesthood, choosing forms of worship from poetic tales.